listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded November 26, 2025. While the maiden media flight of the new tar sands pipeline balloons over BC was rendered awkward last week by the near sinking of an American barge in Fisher Channel off Bella Bella, locals are still wary of the Alaska-Washington state dangerous materials trade, shipping crude and all manner of unrevealed cargo via the inside passage. Much of that concern is due to memories of the pusher tug Nathan E. Stewart that sank and fouled shellfish grounds after separating from its thankfully empty 10,000-ton oil barge in 2016. So, the testy tone of President of Coastal First Nations and elected Chief Counselor Marilyn Slett's response to the press is understandable. When asked, Slett said, quote, "We are tired of learning about these discussions regarding our traditional territories in the press." Ingmar Lee is a longtime BC-based environmentalist and human rights defender whose many articles have appeared at Counterpunch, among other places. Ingmar lives near Bella Bella and is creator of the 10,000-ton oil tanker industry watchdog Facebook page. Ingmar Lee in the first half. And if you haven't seen some of the myriad videos of America's extended Kristallnacht, for God's sakes, turn off your television, cancel your legacy newspaper subscriptions, and wise up while you can. Dave Lindorf is an Izzy Award-winning investigative journalist, author, and founder of the web news site This Can't Be Happening. Dave's book titles include This Can't Be Happening, Resisting the Disintegration of American Democracy, Marketplace Medicine, The Rise of the For-Profit Hospital Change, Killing Time, an investigation into the death row case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and his latest, Spy for No Country, the story of Ted Hall, the teenage atomic spy who may have saved the world. Dave's recent article at This Can't Be Happening's new Substack site, What's With ISIS, Camo, and Assault Rifles, chronicles some of the madness down south. Dave Lindorf with the latest from Crazy Land in the second half. But first, Ingmar Lee and another near-shipping disaster for BC's mid-coast, sullying the waters for the next newest Eastern pipeline dreams. Welcome back to the show, Ingmar.
Hey, Chris. Good to talk to you again.
Well, it's my pleasure, of course. Now, Ingmar, I checked out your picture of Alaska Marine Line's tug Malolo and its lost charge, actually, the barge in question on your Facebook site. Firstly, what's the latest status on the barge?
Well, they were here for, you know, Zephyr and I went out about last week when we first heard about it, and we found the tug and huge container barge. It's probably like a 300 to 500 foot barge just stacked with like hundreds of shipping containers. And, you know, they're a fairly frequent sight on the coast here. They go by two or three times a month, these giant Alaska Marine Lines container barges. And, but this one had an accident somewhere up the coast. We think probably somewhere around Clem 2. Excuse me. And they'd hold the barge. And so one of the compartments in the barge had submerged. And so the rear starboard quarter of the barge was basically underwater. And the first tier of containers on that corner were, you know, in the water. And so this is a pretty alarming situation. We couldn't see any evidence that pumping was going on. And it may be that the discharge from the pumps was underwater as well, so that wasn't visible. But, you know, when vessels start taking on a lot of water, they reach a certain point where they become unstable, and next thing you know, they roll and sink, in which case there would have been literally hundreds of these giant shipping containers, all many of which had diesel reefer units running. You know, they keep those units cold for the whole trip. So, you know, there's hundreds of diesel motors running, and then whatever other stuff is, you know, petroleum products. And, you know, just it would have been an absolute disaster with shipping containers, and some of them float for a while. A lot of them just go straight to the bottom, you know, and there's so much debris and garbage involved. Anyway, we looked at it and it was a very serious situation. And then we came back. Now, the plan had been that they would send up another barge from Washington State. This is an American operation. And it eventually showed up. It took like 2.5 days to get here. Another tug towed up a barge with a big crane on it. And they proceeded to offload about 25 of these containers from the one barge to the other barge. And then the plan was they were going to beach it on King Island. There's a bay there called that has the colonial name of Port John, just north of Evans Inlet. And there's a bit of a beach there that dries out at low tide. And the plan was to beach this huge barge there, and then they could get in there and effect some welding and patch the breach in the hull. But as it turned out, luckily they didn't have to go that far. They unloaded another 25 of these shipping containers, and apparently all the experts that had flown in and come up were satisfied that the barge could carry on and go south back to Washington State, and where it is now, it's now back home. So luckily a much more major disaster was averted. But you know, if more than one of those compartments had been breached in the initial accident, it could have been an entirely different story. And you know, this coast is replete with stories of very near disasters and also of actual disasters. So it's nothing new to us up here that these tug barge units tend to get in trouble on a fairly frequent basis.
Well, I said in the introduction that the locals are wary of this largely unrevealed cargoes that are transiting back and forth. There's nothing forcing the marine lines to reveal or to give warning to anybody along the route that they're carrying dangerous cargo, right?
Yeah, well, certainly there was no apparent divulging of that sort of information, at least in the public sphere. And we don't know, you know, if they eventually did tell that to the Haltsik nation, which is the most concerned agency. You know, DFO, they just sort of go along with whatever the path of the least resistance is, I guess, and, you know, let the Americans do their thing, don't interfere, it's political and all that sort of thing. And it is a big, terrible political nightmare, this whole thing about, you know, if you look on charts, on a marine chart, they refer to the BC Inside Passage, which has, you know, virtually the entire BC coast, with certain area, aside from certain areas where the coast is exposed to ocean going conditions. Most of the BC coast is protected inside passage waters. And so the Americans, they call the BC Inside Passage the Alaska Marine Highway.
Yeah.
And that's even written right on the chart.
It's like the freeway, really, isn't it? There's no cops there, and you know, pedal to the metal, boys.
Yeah, exactly. And it's the same thing with the Arctic. You know, they think the Inside Passage through the Arctic, that's international waters, and they treat it like that. Although, of course, you wouldn't want to allow, you know, heaven forbid, Russian or Chinese ships to pass freely through those so-called international waters. But, you know, the Americans just treat it like their personal highway, and they pay no duties or any sort of tithe that I'm aware of. And there's not a single Canadian job. There's no Canadian pilots. There's no stops in Canada. You know, they just ply back and forth. And then, of course, the Justin Trudeau regime had, been in power during the 2016 sinking of the Nathan E. Stewart, which was a huge disaster up here with an American tug and barge running aground and subsequently sinking the tug and polluting the hell out of Seaforth Channel. When they came to resolve that, like that turned into an enormously expensive political football because there was a large environmental disaster. The company at that time was Kirby Marine, a Texas-based petroleum mover, you know, that operates these sort of pusher tugs mostly in the Mississippi River and down around the so-called, Trump calls it the Gulf of America. Mm-hmm. And those river vessels have just suddenly, they found it convenient to use those to push their petroleum barges up to Alaska through the so-called Alaska Marine Highway. And instead of curtailing that business, there is a very reasonable solution to get those tugs because, see, this is the problem, is the Nathan E. Stewart was a petroleum barge rig that could have been loaded, and it could have been loaded with millions of gallons of diesel or gasoline or other petroleum products when it went aground, as it were. It ran aground empty or virtually empty. We don't know how much gets left in the tanks, but this traffic plies regularly, two or three times a month, up and down the BC coast on an annual basis, some 50-odd trips a year. And, rather than look at the writing on the wall, the Trudeau government could have said, hey, well, we've had this disaster. We want these ships, these petroleum ships, out of our waters. We've declared the North Coast to be a tanker-free zone. And so, therefore, get yourself a proper offshore tanker, like an Aframax tanker, and instead of doing 50 trips up the inside passage of British Columbia and risking all our waters, go offshore where all the rest of the petroleum tanker traffic has to go and build yourself a fuel farm somewhere in Alaska and, offload your fuel into your fuel farm and then deliver it around Alaska with your own tugs in your own waters. But get this traffic out of the water. Instead, Justin Trudeau just kowtowed to the American petroleum industry and said, well, we've got this North Coast tanker ban, but we're going to put in a 12,000 ton weasel word exemption for traffic, for tanker traffic that's less than 12,000 tons. Well, it turns out the average capacity of these Alaska petroleum traffic is around 10,000 deadweight tons. So they've given them ample wiggle room there, and that little weasel clause in the North Coast tanker ban allows for this traffic to continue. When you look at the automatic identification system, the AIS, which is a new technology that every commercial vessel has to broadcast its position, and it so you can go on marine traffic or, if you've got your own AIS system aboard, you can see where other traffic is. There's a system to identify all the traffic. And these pusher tugs, which are pushing barges full of petroleum, the tugboat has to broadcast its position and its identification as a tugboat. But that barge full of, 10,000 deadweight tons of petroleum product is invisible. So, if you look at marine traffic for the BC coast, you'll see all these tugboats everywhere. You know, there's Canadian tugboats and American tugboats all over, and they show up in blue on the map. But some, like maybe at any given time, 5 or 10 of them might be petroleum tugs pushing these barges, but you can't see that. So, you know, the public doesn't identify them as tankers. So I think that before the actual weasel clause of 12,000 deadweight tons was instituted, these tugs were pretending that they weren't tankers, and they just, even if the North Coast tanker ban was in place, they just looked like tugboats, and so everybody just ignored them, and away they went. So it wasn't until the Nathan E. Stewart went down that it became public knowledge that, hey, there's this sleazy petroleum traffic going on that's defying our tanker ban, and what are we going to do about it? And what happened was the transport minister at the time was Mark Garneau. His solution was just to put in that 12,000 ton weasel clause.
Well, but the tankers have been restricted longer than that. I'm thinking of maybe David Anderson or something that kept the tanker out of the Inside Passage to begin with. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Ingmar Lee. Ingmar is a longtime BC-based environmentalist and human rights defender. His many articles have appeared at counterpunch.org for, I don't know, 20-something years now, and in other places too. He lives up near Bella Bella, and he was on the scene for the sinking of the Nathan E. Stewart, and its cargo that didn't go down, even though it was empty, in scare quotes. There is lots of goop and shit in there that would have befouled even more the seabeds, which are still, the shellfish is still not being harvested there now, almost 10 years later, right?
No, that isn't. And that was, you know, historically for thousands of years, Gale Pass up in between Athlone and Dufferin Island, which has, you know, ancient village sites and actually fantastic examples of clam gardening technology and fish trap technology. That's still not being harvested for clams because of that contamination.
Well, Alaska Marine Line spokesperson Ryan Dixon spoke to an Alaska radio station, KRBD, and he said about the Malola and this recent incident. He says he reassured the radio station that no, the barge wasn't carrying groceries that bound for Alaska. You know, obviously, it was going in the other direction. That was their priority, and it didn't contain, quote, bulk cargo or petroleum products. Mm-hmm. So he's not mentioning, of course, all those reefer units that you mentioned, and the fact that the barge itself, you know, but, and they're not saying where it went aground. It just, they didn't say anything other than that. And the photograph that accompanies this little blurb is of these pristine, brand new Alaska Marine Lands Alliance tanker receptacles on shore, not the ones that are rusty old crates that are sinking in somebody else's waters. Well, so as I mentioned in the introduction, now this happened, bad news for the Albertans. The timing was pretty bad for them. Yeah. They're trying to push through the idea of yet another tar sands pipeline that will run across BC to the coast somewhere. I'm not sure where it was meant to land up. Is this supposed to go to Kitimat, or do you know the eventual destination of this kind of proposed, not quite proposed pipeline?
Well, you know, this is the thing that we've become used to, is as soon as Alberta premier starts to run into some political difficulties with their popularity, they raise a plaintive whine that comes drifting over the Rocky Mountains about how, you know, beleaguered the poor landlocked Alberta is, and that BC tree huggers are depriving them of their dirty oil outlet. And, you know, it's just this incessant thing, because every successive Alberta premier, you know, like Rachel Notley, just set up this most annoying, irritating whine, you know, that bleated and bleated and failed and had, you know, the BC public had made it absolutely clear that, no, we don't want these black snake, dirty oil pipelines delivering the filthiest, most carbon-intensive dirty oil into our Pacific coast. And not, the whole world is against it. Like any informed person about the global climate catastrophe knows that that is the absolute worst business you can be into. So anyway, I think with Danielle Smith, this latest thing is just that it's sort of a constant pressure, and she's seen that, you know, Mark Carney has been stumping for mega projects, and, you know, it's his way of, you know, instead of total all-out fawning, kowtowing to Trump to, you know, try and get, you know, Trump to come around with tariffs and stuff like that. He's promising all these major projects. And so Danielle Smith has taken him at his word and jumped in on the bandwagon to start whining for another dirty oil pipeline. And I think probably, you know, as far as I can read on it, it's not really got anything backing it up. I think it's just an opportunistic grab, thinking that, you know, the winds seem to be blowing favorably for big mega projects, and they should just take a stab at it and get on a big bandwagon and try and see if they can inch their pipeline dreams a little bit forward. I really don't believe anybody's taking it seriously, but of course the corporate media, they see first of all, the corporate media is always in favor of more pipelines and that sort of thing. So they also smell a fight, which sells newspapers and, you know, TV time and all that. So they're sort of amping it up and making it out like it's much more serious of a proposal than it actually is. That's sort of my read on it. But it's kind of scary because you hear Mark Carney sort of making the usual motions, and, you know, they've already got, you know, secret negotiations going with Saskatchewan, Scott Moe, and all that sort of thing. And, you know, David Eby, being the slime ball that he is, he'll probably be just like John Horgan in Site C. He'll go all, you know, Site C sucks and we're going to use every tool in our war chest to stop it. And then eventually just come around and kowtow and grovel and, yeah, we can put another pipeline in, you know. But, well, you know.
But we can agree that Site C has been despite our pessimism, has been a grand success, right? It didn't run over budget or ruin all of the farmland that we worried about and all these other things, right? Sorry, yeah. Folks. That's radio sarcasm.
Yeah, I was going, what are you talking about?
I've lost it. Well, the CBC seem to be taking it seriously, as you say. There's a at their website, some BC Liberal MPs concerned about prospect of a new oil pipeline, colon sources. So they're not telling us who says this. Deal expected Thursday, tomorrow, on conditions for pipeline to Northwest BC. They say, oh, yes, Mark Carney is poised to sign a, quote, grand bargain with Alberta later this week. Some BC Liberal MPs are raising concerns. Ottawa giving green light to a new oil pipeline. And then they, again, their anonymous sources say in the TC coverage a week ago now, almost, they quote Ellis Ross, a BC Conservative MP up in Prince Rupert, not too far from you.
Yeah.
Well, up that way anyway. He said, and he says, which I found interesting, and he says what's interesting about the oil tanker ban is that, quote, Canada has the constitutional authority to do this, the pipeline, and open, and subsequently opening, you know, getting rid of the ban, because that's going to be a part of it. And it's quite interesting, says our friend Ellis, that the province of BC seems to feel they're exempt from the constitutional accommodation duties of First Nations. Yeah. So he's saying, well, but the First Nations are all on board with this, at least if I'm reading his his remarks correctly. Is that the case up where you are? Do you have an indication that people up there would be okay with this pipeline and the opening up of the tanker ban?
No, not at all. And, you know, the coastal First Nations, which is includes, you know, the Gitgat and Haltsik and, you know, Tlaq, like, they're completely opposed to it. And, you know, there's not a person in Bella Bella that wants it. And the chief, Marilyn Slett, has already been quite outspoken against it. And we've already fought off the Enbridge problem, the Enbridge pipeline, which they've started into that proposal with $100 million public relations budget, and it was still defeated largely by the 100 staunch opposition of the coastal First Nations. But Ellis Ross is a First Nation, and he has a long history of, you know, being a lackey of the oil and gas and logging and all that industry. And he been trying for a long time to get elected, and he did end up getting elected. And he's going to be there. That's, I think, the pipeline lobby is, you know, put a lot of effort into getting Mr. Ross elected there, and he's now doing their bidding. My sense is that...
Oh, we've lost Igmar. Well, go to Igmar's site. It's on Facebook. It is active. 10,000, the numeral 10,000-ton tanker. After the break, I'm going to be joined by Dave Lindorf down in the States. We're going to talk about what's going on down there with ICE and the militarization of everything, it seems. Sorry to lose you, Igmar. Coming up in the transition, more from David Rovics and his new partner, iSuno. Moscow, Tokyo, New York. Guerrilla Radio is everywhere. Everywhere, all the time.
Chicago. Jakarta. Helsinki. Cape Town. Sao Paulo. Manchester. Bangalore. And somewhere in Russia, I can't actually remember the name of.
Big man on the TV says we've got to send the army in to liberate our country from the enemy within. The big man on the TV says this city is on fire. Though a walk in any neighborhood says he's just a liar. When what you see is poverty, people dying sick and alone. When I look around, what I see is a class war zone. The big man on the TV says the future is at stake. So we cut taxes on the rich and then we take the lives. The things you could once afford before the president became the chairman of the board. It was bad before, as recent history has shown. But now it's even worse here in this class war zone. Big man on the TV says we'll make America great. We'll implement this program. Class Wars.
And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, if you haven't seen some of the myriad videos of America's extended Kristallnacht, for God's sakes, turn off your television, cancel your legacy newspaper subscriptions, and wise up while you still can. Dave Lindorf is an Izzy Award-winning investigative journalist, author, and founder of the web news site This Can't Be Happening. Dave's book titles include This Can't Be Happening, Resisting the Disintegration of American Democracy, Marketplace Medicine, The Rise of the For-Profit Hospital Chains, Killing Time, An Investigation into the Death Row Case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and his latest is Spy for No Country, the story of Ted Hall, the teenage atomic spy who may have saved the world. Dave's recent article